The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're exploring our relationship with insects, both physically and mentally. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. A little later on, we'll talk to entomologist Eric Benbow about the use of insects as a tool for forensic investigation. But first, my guest is Jeffrey Lockwood. Jeffrey worked for 15 years as an insect ecologist at the University of Wyoming, publishing more than 100 scientific papers and pioneering a method of integrated pest management for rangeland grasshoppers. In 2003, he became a professor of natural sciences and humanities in the Department of Philosophy and the Program in Creative Writing, where he teaches environmental ethics, philosophy of ecology, and nature-environmental writing. He's here to talk about his third book, The Infested Mind, Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, most writers have some kind of inspiration for writing their books, but not all can point to a catalyst quite as spectacular as yours. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It's a very memorable date, sort of burned into my memory. I'd been working with rangeland grasshoppers, kind of ecology and pest management for a number of years, and I was out in the field by myself, although my research crew had been out the week before and told me about a location where there was a phenomenally dense outbreak of grasshoppers. And of course, you know, it's sort of like a storm chaser, right? I had to go and see this. And so I drove myself out there and did the work I needed to do and then headed out to this place called Whalen Canyon, which is a canyon that sort of opens out onto the prairie. And as it opens out, there's some very deeply etched gullies. And so the grasshoppers on the uplands were maybe, it was pretty high density, 30 or 40 per square meter. The area looked like someone had driven over it with a riding lawnmower. It was just cut flat from the grasshoppers feeding. And what had happened was there were still some green areas down in the bottoms of these gullies. And so that's where, and I didn't know it as I walked into this gully, that's where they had amassed in just phenomenal numbers, probably 100, 150 grasshoppers per square yard. It was just a living, bristling carpet of grasshoppers. And as I descended, they began to sort of emerge in kind of a chaotic eruption, flying, jumping, bouncing off me. There was no order to their motion. And as they were both coming at me and away from me, they were, you know, latching onto my clothing, crawling inside my shirt, clinging to my skin. And this hadn't happened to me before. I had a full-blown, in retrospect, I know what it is now, panic response. You know, I started breathing hard. I started wiping at the grasshoppers. Heart started pounding. And I got out of there as in kind of a stumbling run back to the truck, which kind of sounds crazy. And I guess in a sense, of, you know, when you're in the midst of a panic attack, you're not entirely sane. And I got back to the truck and just felt weak, kind of shocky, got into the truck and wasn't really sort of processing what had happened to me, started driving home. And the reaction kind of faded. But I tell you, every time there was a little tickle of sweat running down my back or something, I would swat at it and whatnot. And I got home hoping that whatever it was that had happened to me, which felt like some sort of a waking nightmare, would just never happen again. But then I began to get very anxious. What if this happened when there were other people present, my research associates or graduate students? What would it mean for me wanting to go back out into that sort of a grasshopper density? And so it became a source of anxiety and an experience that I just couldn't get out of my mind. And I think in part, it certainly catalyzed my deep curiosity about myself and may have catalyzed my move from the sciences into the arts and humanities, because that was sort of the realm, at least the psychological sciences, that was the realm that from which I began to understand what had happened to me, and it was something that happens to lots of people. So that's sort of the long and the short of it, but the hair on the back of my arm still stands up when I tell the story.
Well, the hair on the back of my arm stood up when I read that story. And and that was actually the point where I thought, this is going to be a rough book to read, because I assume that I am not the only one who has told you that they itched their way through your book.
Yeah, there's actually, it's funny, there is a section in there on itching. You know, itching is one of the most sort of contagious. As a matter of fact, when you read about itching, you get itchy. And I swear, this is completely honest. As I'm talking to you, I'm beginning to feel itchy. And when I was writing that section, I could not write more than 4 or 5 sentences, even knowing the psychology, right, without starting to scratch. You know, what I'd like to know is how many of your listeners, as we're talking about, you know, things crawling on you and the itchiness, now are beginning to feel themselves, that sort of a little tickle, right at the base of their scalp or sort of at their back or something.
Oh, but so many people have that amazingly visceral response to not just the itching, but sort of the response to bugs altogether. And in your book, attempts to explore exactly why that is. So to do that, you first tried to identify the difference between fear and disgust, because they are different but related emotions, correct?
Yes, they're related in that they're both what we might call aversive, right? They're unpleasant. They're both responses to something that we want to get away from. But fear is a response to danger. Disgust is an aversion, but the danger is of a different kind. Generally, we take disgust to be a response to or an avoidance of an invasion or contamination or even sometimes an excess. And these are not sort of immediately life-threatening or immediately harmful, as danger is. And, of course, disgust tends to be rooted in the intimate senses, smell, taste, and touch. Fear is often triggered by both sound and sight. So there are some interesting similarities. Both are protective mechanisms. Both are universal. All people around the world exhibit both fear and disgust. So they're one of the 7 or 8 universal emotions. But different things trigger them, and the physiology of fear is different than the physiology of disgust. Nobody, when seeing a tiger, would feel like throwing up.
Well put. So then they do lead to different physical responses then?
They do. Basically, in response to fear, what we want to do is put distance, space between us and the object of our fear. Disgust, a lot of times, we want to remove it from our presence rather than us from its presence. I don't know sort of how graphic to be, but, you know, think
feel
about,
free.
You know, feces and vomit and mucus and all of
right.
those things. We don't go running out of the room. What we want to do is clean them up. Right? We actually engage them sort of in a repulsive kind of way. So if you walk into your house and there's a snarling dog, you slam the door. If you walk into your house and your own dog pooped on the carpet, you don't slam the door, you clean it up.
Well, and there's actually been quite a bit of research into disgust.
Absolutely. A lot of it's been relatively recent. It's sort of like it's the new white rat of emotions. It's getting lots of attention. There's been a number of books come out. And insects are really good. Some of the insects are really good triggers of disgust. And so, you know, we can elicit disgust with in various ways. And certainly, I mean, the classic triggers are bodily fluids and things of that nature. But within the animal world, things that are slippery, things that are slimy, things that are creepy, things that occur in sort of an appalling profusion, all of which are pretty fine descriptions. I mean, probably the ultimate stimulus of disgust is something like writhing maggots in a rotting cadaver. That's got it all.
That was vivid. So they've, but there has been research done within a lab using human subjects on disgust.
Yes, and one of the most interesting ways of sorting out fear and disgust is this sort of little experiment, the spider cookie test. Imagine that you're sitting at a table across from a person in a lab coat, as these things always are, and there's a cookie there, a nice chocolate chip cookie, and you're kind of hungry. And the researcher takes out a jar and dumps out a spider, and the spider scrambles across that cookie, right? And then over to the other side of the table, and then is put back in the jar. If a person is only afraid of spiders, then once the spider is no longer present and no longer on the cookie, then the person would have no reservations about eating the cookie. On the other hand, if the person finds a spider disgusting, one of the qualities of disgust is this transferability or contamination. And so people who find spiders disgusting, even though the spider is no longer present, are not going to eat that cookie because the spider had walked on it. And so the spider cookie test is kind of a way of getting in our straight in our own heads. I mean, imagine that happens to you. Would you eat that cookie?
I would eat that cookie.
Okay. So well, I know, but some of us have higher cookie preferences than others. No.
Right.
So that suggests that you're not particularly disgusted by spiders, but I don't know about you. You may be afraid of spiders. In other words, you may back away from the table when the spider gets dumped
right.
on it, but after the tarantulas crawl off the cookie, then it's a perfectly fine cookie. But for many people, well, now let's do the same experiment with a cockroach.
Oh, I'm out.
Right?
I'm out.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Right. You're not eating that cookie, are you?
So where does that come from exactly? Why? What is the reasoning as to why some of us are so disgusted by insects? Because there's
right.
a lot of proposed reasoning.
Yes, there is. And what happens is scientists sometimes tend to set themselves up in opposing camps. And so we can think of there being two camps, right? And there's the evolutionary biology or evolutionary psychology camp who want to explain all of our responses to fearful and disgusting stimuli in terms of kind of a hardline evolutionary psychology. Those who exhibited fear and disgust in the presence of certain stimuli were more successful in leaving offspring. And so those people who did not find multi-legged creatures or creatures with no legs, that is snakes, sources of fright, they may have fared poorly in terms of leaving offspring. Likewise, people who didn't find fecal material disgusting and were willing to handle it may have gotten themselves sick and died of various pathogens. So, and what the evolutionary psychologists, the term they use, which I really like, is prepared learning. I think that's sort of a softer version of the hardline position. The basic idea is that we are prepared to learn that certain stimuli are sources of aversion. So it's very easy, for instance, to have a child learn to fear a spider. It's much more difficult to teach a young child to fear a bunny, right? Because they're soft and furry and they move slowly. Spiders are not. I think of it, we're prepared in the same way, for instance, that we're prepared to learn a language, right? And so we're very good as babies or as young children picking up on grammatical structures, words, vocabulary, and things like that. Because we're not just a blank slate, right? There's certain things we learn very readily, such as language. And the evolutionary psychologist argues there's also stimuli that we're able to learn very quickly as being a source of disgust or fear. Now, the other side of that divide, the other camp, would be the cultural people who would argue that, well, evolutionary psychology does a little bit of work, but come on, people are afraid of all sorts of things that don't have a evolutionary story. I mean, how many times in human evolution have we been threatened by clowns?
Exactly.
Right?
Very good point.
So what these people want to argue is that it's all culturally constructed, that we are equally likely to learn anything, and that it really is just sort of this cultural tradition that's been handed down over generations, and that we're just culturally conditioned to fear insects because our parents feared insects and their parents feared insects, and this traces back to certain events in human history. But it's not thought to be an evolutionary tendency. It's simply a cultural construct. Now, I think the two extremes are just implausible, and the truth lies, as often is the case, somewhere in between, that we do as a culture convey to children who are very receptive what objects in their environment ought to be sources of aversion, either fear or disgust. Think of mothers and fathers saying, oh, don't touch that, put it down, you don't know where it's been, which in parent talk means, I know where it's been, put it down, right? And children are very good at modeling adult behavior, and so they've shown, and this is a bit complicated, but they've shown that children will learn very readily the aversions of their parents. And of course, teasing that out from genetics, which can be done with twin studies, is a bit complicated. And it does seem that there is, within fearful people or fearful family lineages, there is a genetic tendency for fear. But there also seems to be a kind of conditioning on the part of the parents to condition their children to fear the sorts of things that they fear. So it's basically both a nature and nurture problem.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm here with Jeffrey Lockwood, author of The Infested Mind, Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. So if you take all that together, regardless of where it comes from, entomophobia is still a very common phobia, right?
By some accounts, you know, as much as 6% of the population, depending on country, that's U.S. population. I suspect it wouldn't be dramatically different from Canada. But different countries and different cultures have different levels. But, you know, U.S., about 1 in 15 people probably experience a potentially clinical degree of entomophobia. That's, you know, somewhere around 20 million people. That's a lot of people.
And you actually pointed out in the book, which I thought was really interesting, some trends among those who experience this.
Right. It's not evenly distributed. Women tend to exhibit entomophobia at dramatically higher rates than do men. Now, of course, we can talk about social and cultural modeling there. So it's not clear whether how much of that is an artifact of culture and how much of that might be an evolutionary tendency. It's probably a complicated relationship between those two. Education has kind of a complicated relationship with entomophobia. To a certain degree, the more educated you are, the less entomophobic you are. But then there's a point at which that seems to level off and the effect disappears. Interestingly enough, I mean, this is sort of a little bit contrary to what I would have guessed. Students who have taken college courses in biology tend to exhibit slightly higher levels of fear rather than lower.
That is counterintuitive.
Now, I'm not sure, and again, parsing out fear and disgust can be very difficult. Mm-hmm. It might be that they simply have greater knowledge of the biological world, and that knowledge confers a kind, I mean, so, okay, so here's the example from my own life, right? Before I took parasitology, I didn't have a problem eating a rare steak.
But now you know exactly what goes on.
Now I know what, yeah.
Oh,
yeah, so
okay.
There may be some of that going on. Yeah, there's nothing that ruins a rare steak like a semester-long course in parasitology.
Oh. So I should ask, what's the difference between a fear and a phobia then?
Well, a fear is, in a sense, a perfectly reasonable, adaptive response to danger in the world. And a phobia basically is taken to have the qualities of being persistent, so it doesn't necessarily go away readily. It's excessive, which is hard to sort of quantify, but, you know, if you go into your laundry room and there's a spider, you might take a step back, right? Mm. An entomophobe or an arachnophobe might go screaming out of the house, lock the door, and not go back for 3 days. So we take it to be a persistent, excessive, and the other quality is unreasonable. And of course, to the entomophobe or the arachnophobe, it's perfectly reasonable. What are you talking about? There's a spider in the laundry room. So it's sort of measured against sort of this cultural or social norm, and it's also measured against sort of biological reality, right? Is the spider really, you know, does it warrant that level of panic or that severity of reaction? You know, spiders and insects, snakes and things like that are a little more complicated in terms of this excessive and unreasonableness. Other simple phobias are much, much clearer, right? It just doesn't seem like it's reasonable to be afraid of clowns.
But it is, yet.
Right, yeah. It doesn't seem like it is, but right. Any sane person knows.
I think we're on the same page here, sir. Yes.
That clowns are dangerous, right. What the hell are you talking about?
No, you wrote just a bunch on phobias, and I have some specific questions about it. If you have one phobia, are you more likely to have other phobias?
Well, you are. I mean, there is what they call comorbidity. Not only are you likely to have other phobias, but you're also likely to have other disorders such as anxiety. Fear is a response to danger, so the danger is present and you respond to it. Anxiety is the anticipation of danger. We're anxious about, right, encountering a dangerous thing. We're fearful at the moment of encounter. And so fear and anxiety tend to go hand in hand oftentimes. Fear and disgust are often seen together as well. Excessive fear is often correlated with excessive responses in terms of disgust. And of course, there's also some other indications that things like alcohol abuse may be a way of self-medicating for some phobic individuals. And so as people are trying to deal with their anxieties and their fears, that may trigger these other sort of maladaptive psychological states. And so and what people end up doing for the most part is coming up sort of like with workarounds, right? They just don't go down into the basement. They don't look under the kitchen sink, or they don't go out to the woodshed, or they let somebody else collect the firewood. You know, and in the modern world, especially the urban world, you know, we can spend a lot of our lives pretty functionally not contacting many insects. And so a lot of people live with it and just avoid the triggers. But that's not really necessary. There are some very effective treatments, and it's not necessary to sort of shape our lives around our entomophobia.
So now, of course, the big question is, where do these phobias come from? What are the range of theories we're working with here?
There's quite a range of theories, and one of the theories has to do with an individual's negative experience. And so I might have a negative experience with, I remember as a kid, I had a bee fly down the back of my shirt when I was about 5 or 6 years old and sting me, and I knew it was inside that. And actually, I'm not terribly fearful of bees, but had I been terribly fearful of bees, that, you know, I could maybe trace it back to that. A lot of phobics actually can't trace their fear of an insect back to an encounter with an insect, or a spider for that matter. And those two tend to get confounded in people's terminology. So I know you've got some very scientifically literate listeners who will probably cringe when I start muddling those two together. But really, in the minds of a lot of people, they don't sort 8 legs from 6 legs. It's a multi-legged thing. And even the psychologists tend to muddle those together a bit. Entomologists are much more specific. So it might be a person's individual encounter. Another possibility is the modeling. You see a parent or an adult or even a sibling in some cases exhibit fear. And sometimes there appears to be, interestingly enough, no identifiable point of origin. It's difficult or impossible. I mean, perhaps there's kind of a childhood amnesia and the child doesn't remember or the parent doesn't remember, but there are instances in which neither parent nor child can come up with an incident that triggered it. And in those cases, it could be social messages, you know, it could be media, it could be culture. Sometimes it's very clear that there's an incident. Other times it's not clear that there is a trigger, and its origin remains obscure.
So what we're saying is, no idea.
There's no universal.
Perfect.
There's no, for individuals, it may be right. Very clear. There is no universal origin for phobias.
Right. Now, you've also written about a number of case studies where people like insects. like them a little too much is what I'm talking about here. And I suppose we probably should get you to talk about that. Yeah, go ahead, sir. You know what I'm talking about.
Right. There's a set of psychosexual disorders that kind of fall under the category called paraphilia, which is basically what we take to be sexual arousal by an object or a situation that society deems abnormal, right? That one ought not to be sexually aroused by that. And one of the forms of paraphilia is a phenomenon called formicophilia. Formico is a reference to ants. Ants are in the family Formicidae. And one of the earliest well-documented cases involved a young man who achieved sexual gratification by having ants crawling on his genitals. He also used other insects crawling on his genitals. There's been cases involving flies, worms, which are not insects, but, you know, we can... And actually, formicophilia now has been sort of expanded to include virtually any other kind of insect as well. There's arachnophilia, which is much the same, where... Now, if you imagine this... And so here's where it makes sense, right? So some people...
Do tell.
So the bodily neurophysiology, heart physiology, breathing physiology of fear is a physiology of arousal, right? Your heart is beating fast, your breath is coming fast, right? You're a little lightheaded. This actually sounds a bit like being sexually aroused. And in fact, the physiology of fear and the physiology of sexual arousal are really quite similar. And so people will, for instance, use a spider, right, in a jar on the bedstand to arouse their partner. I don't know if you remember that scene from 007 I can't remember which of the movies it was. Anyway, he ends up with a spider in bed with him, and I've always thought that was a particularly bizarrely sexual scene. Anyway, now so there's been experiments that show if two people meet, for instance, on a high building or on a high bridge for the first time, and then the investigator asks the individuals to report how attractive the other person was, they invariably report a higher level of attraction if, in fact, they're meeting at a location that is engendering a kind of fear, right? High building or a high bridge. And what's happening, we think, is that, in a sense, they're mistaking their elevated heart rate, their elevated respiration, because they're standing near an edge. They attribute that to a positive sexual response to the other person. What this means is that when you go out on a first date, you should take the person to a horror movie and then out for a triple espresso. That's a strategy. Okay, so the idea that insects elicit this fearful response is something that's just exploited in a psychosexual sense. So that's one realm of paraphilia. The really bizarre one is something called crush fetishism, in which people derive sexual, men, I don't know if there's any documented cases of women, but men, probably just a few men, find the image of a woman crushing a biological object. Sometimes it can be something as innocuous as fruit. Oftentimes it involves animals, particularly what they call soft crush. Involves things like insects, worms, spiders being crushed under a woman's foot. And then there's the hard crush, which is apparently very rare, but that involves crushing vertebrates, kittens, and things like that. That is so rare that it sort of bumps up against the possibility of a bit of urban myth, although it apparently does exist. And so this actually is a phenomenon that's out there. There was some films made for crush fetishists. They generated a tremendous response from political bodies, very sort of complicated questions about, you know, freedom and artistic freedom. And there was the spokesman for crush fetishism asked this question, and I thought it was incredibly compelling. He said, look, many of you in this room, he was actually speaking to Congress, I believe, at that time, derive a great deal of sensory pleasure from eating meat. Right. And so you have no problem with raising sentient animals in appalling conditions and then killing them to gratify your culinary desires. All I do is derive sexual satisfaction from crushing insects. Which of us is engaged in the less moral behavior? You know, it's like, ooh, that's kind of good.
Fantastic question. And this is Science for the People. And we'll be back with more Jeffrey Lockwood and his book, The Infested Mind, after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined today by Jeffrey Lockwood, Professor of Natural Sciences and Humanities in the Department of Philosophy and the Program in Creative Writing at the University of Wyoming. He's the author of The Infested Mind, Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. Now, I very much appreciate all the research you looked and all the case studies. Some of them are, you know, more uncomfortable than others, but some of them were absolutely fascinating. Some of the case studies you looked at were where people had responses to insects that weren't even there or potentially did not exist. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what you learned about illusory parasitosis?
It's an absolutely fascinating. There's actually these three phenomena. And actually, the literature kind of muddles them together sometimes. There's hallucinations, there's illusions, and there's delusions. All right, hallucinations arise from what we might call internal perceptions. There's nothing there. All right, and so when we're having a hallucination, we might see spiders on the wall. All right, when there's no spiders on the walls at all. One of the probably the most important kinds of hallucinations regarding insects is something we call formication. And again, the formic refers to ants. And so a formication is what's called a tactile illusion. Rather than seeing something that isn't there, you feel something that isn't there, kind of a tickling. And this is a common symptom associated with some drug use. As a matter of fact, it's so common that they refer to it as cocaine bugs or crank bugs. With meth use, people will scratch their skin raw trying to eliminate the insect. And so that's a hallucination. An illusion is when something exists in the world, there's a sensory stimulus, but we misperceive it. And so a classic case of illusory parasitosis took place, a whole series of these cases took place in the 1960s, mostly among female office workers. And it became so common at that time that they even called these non-existent insects table bugs. And what it was a phenomenon in which there was a real stimulus, and that was sort of a tingling sensation or an itchy sensation, but it was misattributed to having insects crawling on you. So there's really something happening, but what you're doing is having an illusion, right? There's a real stimulus, but you're misperceiving it. And they were often associated at that time with women wearing nylons and nylon dresses, which tended to generate the static discharges on their lower legs and ankles, as well as some other sort of common office sorts of stimuli at that time. And then the worst case in many ways is a delusion or a delusion, and there's a delusory parasitosis. And in this case, and it's a subtle difference, not only are you mistaken about your perception, but you've got a full-blown erroneous belief. And so the person with delusory parasitosis has this complete story and belief in their mind that they are infested. What we have seen historically is what was called the matchbox sign. I know extension entomologists and exterminators sort of wince when they see somebody come in with a matchbox, or today it might be the Ziploc sign. You come in with this Ziploc bag with a whole bunch of crumpled Kleenex in it, and the person says, these things have been crawling in my body, or they've been crawling on my body, or they're in my bed. And you look and you look and you look, and there's nothing there. There's lint and there's dust and whatnot, but there's nothing there. But the person is absolutely convinced that their home or their body is infested. And these are very difficult cases. It's sort of an unshakable belief. These people often do tremendous physical damage to themselves by scratching, by cutting, by digging with implements to remove the non-existent insects from under their skin or from their scalp. They'll often saturate their skin or their scalp with all sorts of horrible poisons, toxins, chemicals, bathe themselves in pesticides, all in an effort to eliminate an infestation that doesn't exist.
The stories you wrote about in the book, the case studies, were absolutely heartbreaking.
Oh, they are. And if anyone is sort of really interested in this phenomenon, there's a movie, I think it's a 1996 movie called Bugged. And it's this fantastic film about delusory parasitosis. And there's actually a phenomenon in which families or couples can basically become, it's like a contagion. Other people begin feeling and responding to these non-existent insects, just like itchiness is contagious. And so this misattribution can happen to multiple individuals. And this film is about how this happens between this man and a woman, and to the point where there's an incredibly climactic scene. But it's as if at no point from one scene to the next can you identify the moment of insanity. Each step seems plausible, until you've got this full-blown insane situation. And so it is heartbreaking, and I think it is in some ways because we sort of get it, right? You know, you're out in the backyard doing a barbecue, or you're having a picnic, and you feel something on your neck, right? And you do this quick slap, and you realize that it was just a seed, or there's really nothing there. But that's sort of this misattribution. And so I think we're actually fairly empathetic to this sort of a psychological condition. We can almost imagine how it could happen to us.
Well, and there's actually a lot of debate within the medical community around the ethical way to deal with these kind of issues, aren't there?
Yes, it's very difficult. There is this question of whether one should confront the individual with the false belief. That's probably not a great idea for a non-professional, and oftentimes these individuals I'm scratching my head right now. These
I've been doing it the entire interview.
These individuals will often make first contact with exterminators or entomology extension agents, sometimes with dermatologists. And none of these people are particularly well-trained in psychological disorders. My colleagues in extension entomology have encountered individuals with delusory parasitosis on a regular, not a very frequent, but a fairly regular basis over time. And if you challenge them too strongly, they simply reject you and move on to somebody else. And so the key is to not to reinforce or endorse their belief, but to try to get them into the presence of a professional who can help them deal with the delusion. If you tell them they're delusional, they're likely to reject, understandably, because they believe, they firmly and absolutely believe that there's something happening to them. So it's a very difficult matter. The prognosis is not particularly great either. There's various drugs that have been used and various therapies that have been used. There's stories back in the 50s and 60s of basically exterminators coming in and spraying water in people's houses who claim to have infestations when none existed, sort of a placebo, which now is considered to be completely unethical.
Right.
But in some cases, it worked. And so then you end up with this question of, well, you relieved suffering by telling a lie, and it becomes quite an interesting philosophical conundrum. But today, no credible exterminator would treat a person or their house without there actually being an infestation.
Well, since we're talking about treatment, so for people who do have entomophobia,
mm-hmm.
real bugs, what are their options? You talk about in the book a variety of tools in the therapist's toolbox, as it were. Maybe you go through those for us?
Yeah, I can. Just real quickly. I mean, the first tool, of course, this is modern society, is we can give somebody a drug. And basically, that's probably almost always a bad idea, unless there's some sort of extremely severe and life-threatening sort of self-damaging response. You know, some of the people with delusory parasitosis who are ripping open wounds and whatnot. But short of that, basically all the drug does is mask symptoms, and it really doesn't deal with underlying psychological disorders. So that's, except in extreme circumstances, that's probably not a very good resort. Some people have tried psychoanalysis. There's very little empirical support that it's particularly efficacious. Hypnotherapy has been used, also very little evidence that it's efficacious. And then we end up with this sort of broad category of therapies called exposure therapies, where a person either imagines or even more effectively makes physical contact with the object of their fear. And so these are variously called systematic desensitization if it's sort of a gradual process. There's something called implosion therapy or implosive therapy if it's thrusting the person into a contact with the object of their fear. These can be very traumatic, a systematic desensitization, not so much. But really, you know, from what my research has told me and from what my interviews with various people in the field have told me, there's sort of the rock star of treating these straightforward phobias, and it's called cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. You can think of the person is encouraged by the therapist to sort of treat themselves as a subject of an experiment, right? And so what's your hypothesis? Your hypothesis is, if that grasshopper comes near me, it will crawl inside my ear and eat my brain. And then you say, well, let's under controlled circumstances, let's let the grasshopper, you know, be in the same room with you and see if it really does come after you. And so it's a matter of this sort of sequential empirical testing of what the therapist understands to be false beliefs. And so it's cognitive in that the patient is asked to think about the nature of the fear and then to behaviorally test it. Is that fear plausible? Let's go see, right? And it's basically both scientific and a kind of a therapeutic art, because moving a person too quickly can be damaging. Moving them too slowly may not be effective. But there's good evidence that shows that even a single therapeutic session under the management of a capable and experienced psychologist can result in long-term diminishment of simple phobias. And so this can be very potent. Sometimes, of course, it takes multiple trials or multiple therapeutic sessions, but it seems to have a very high success rate. It's not particularly time-consuming. It's not traumatic for the patient. And in a sense, I think it's very much freeing. And one of the exciting things is that cognitive behavioral therapy for phobias is one of the few cases in the field of psychology in which we've got an absolutely well-grounded, empirically tested treatment with a very, very high success rate for a difficult psychological disorder. Things like depression, anxiety disorders, obsessive-compulsive disorders, we don't have nearly the success rate. But if a person has got a fear of X, there really is no reason for them to have to live with that. And what's interesting is how few people actually seek therapy for their fears. They end up sometimes with these very complex lives to avoid the stimulus of their fear, which is really tragic because, as I say, it's one of the psychological disorders that we have an honest-to-goodness, well-grounded treatment for, and we need not live in fear of things like spiders and snakes and clowns.
Well, we need not to. But what if we're fairly comfortable with it at this point? Are you one of the people that think that we should all make an effort to love insects? Are you one of those? Because I've heard that from many entomologists. They say that that we just have to give them a chance and dig a little deeper into ourselves, and we would all love bugs as much as they do.
Nah.
Do tell.
That would be a lovely world, right, in which all people love all living things. I don't find that particularly plausible. I think that it is perfectly okay to be ambivalent towards certain things in your world. I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, you know, it's just not a full and rewarding life to live in fear of things, right? So that's kind of a suffering, a self, you know, why would one want to live a life of fear? But there's a big difference between fear and sort of loving everything that you come into contact with. And so I actually think that, and I coined this weird term in the book called entomoapathia. Apathia means apathy, right? I think we can simply be apathetic toward insects, such that they don't do us psychological harm, and we don't go around doing them physical harm. You know, and spraying pesticides and stomping on insects and whatnot, that's not a particularly pleasant way to live, crushing the life out of other things or living in fear. I mean, we could aspire to having this sort of deep appreciation of all living things, and I think that's a fine thing. But for the most part, I think live and let live would be a significant step in a sane direction. And so I think that practicing the virtue of tolerance is a perfectly fine way of dealing with certain creatures and certain phenomena in the natural world.
Jeffrey, thanks very much for being here.
You bet. I appreciate it. I'll leave you and your listeners to scratch yourselves into perhaps good memories of this program. And I hope that people consider sort of moving from wherever they are, if it's fear, to moving into a place of tolerance, from tolerance perhaps into a place of genuine appreciation. I think heading in that direction is a direction that leads us into a more fulfilling life.
And you can find a link to Jeffrey Lockwood and his book, The Infested Mind, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be back with entomologist Eric Benbow to talk about insects, crime scenes, and death right after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're looking at the power of stories and innuendo to shape the public perception of science. We'll speak to author John Lee about his book, An Epidemic of Rumors, How Stories Shape Our Perceptions of Disease. And we're joined by Dr. Paul Offit, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the Director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, to get the scientific perspective on the safety and effectiveness of vaccinations. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Next up on Science for the People, I'm Desiree Schell, joined by Dr. Eric Benbow. Eric is currently an assistant professor in the departments of entomology and osteopathic medical specialties at Michigan State University. His research involves microbial invertebrate community interactions in aquatic ecosystems, disease systems, and carrion ecology and evolution, with applications in forensics. He was the president of the North American Forensic Entomology Association from 2012 to 2013. Very good to have you here, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I have been wanting to have someone come on the show to talk about forensic entomology since we first began the show, so this is very exciting. Can we start out by explaining to people that maybe don't watch police procedurals what forensic entomology is?
Sure. It's the use of insects and often other arthropods in criminal investigations or any part of the legal process. It's typically thought of to be used in homicide investigations or violent crimes, but there's also another part of forensic entomology associated with stored products. So if you find a grasshopper in a can of green beans, was it placed there or was it part of the packaging process? But for the most part, it's using insects and other arthropods, and most often with some kind of homicide or other violent crime.
Well, and now the field and the specific methods used, they have changed quite a bit over the years, correct?
Yes, they have. Still, you know, some of the first methods, one was using the sequence of insects and other arthropods that colonize a body. Essentially, it's a community succession where, you know, you have one species that comes into a new resource. It modifies that resource in a way that facilitates or inhibits the next species. So forensic entomologists have used the sequence of insect species that colonize a corpse to identify or estimate the time since that individual had been colonized by them, which often was very close to when the person died. The second way that forensic entomologists have used insects in these kinds of crime scenes is, for instance, when an investigator collects a certain size maggot or a bunch of maggots of a certain size and certain species, they can use the size of that as a surrogate for its age. And if they know the temperature of the crime scene preceding the discovery of the body, they can calibrate back and determine when the larvae was first laid on the resource, or laid as an egg and then developed into the larvae. And so you can back calculate and get the time of insect colonization using the developmental stages of the insects themselves.
And I assume you've integrated a lot more technology into this field as well.
Yes, several researchers have done some really good work trying to develop new statistical models to put confidence intervals or understand the variation around some of these time since death estimates. More recently, several research groups have been using microbial communities in a way that we think influences insect behavior and therefore how insects colonize a body, but also using the microbial communities themselves in the same way, using successional patterns to estimate the time since death in that way.
So present day, what kinds of insects are we talking about here?
They really haven't changed. We're looking primarily at blowflies, those flies that you typically find in and around waste. You certainly find it on roadkills and carrion in the natural ecosystems. And also flesh flies are another big taxonomic group that are used in forensic entomology and are often found in crime scenes. And there's a variety of others, but those are the big ones. Then there's a bunch of different beetles as well, and those are usually later on in the decay process.
So walk me through how this would look. Somebody dies, and then what do the insects do?
Oftentimes, and there's still a lot of research out there trying to understand this, but the flies cue in on the dead body. We're still trying to figure out how they do this. And they can be there within minutes. Oftentimes it's within hours or a day. But with carrion resources or, you know, in the natural system, we've observed flies coming in within 10 minutes of death, or at least of something dead being exposed to the environment. So they get there really fast. They spend some time investigating the resource. They regurgitate on it. They evacuate their guts onto it as well. We think tasting in some ways to evaluate the resource. Then once they decide that if the resource is quality or not, the adult females will lay their eggs, oftentimes in wounds, in the orifices of the head, in the urogenital area, in the anal area. looking, we think, for more moist environments for the eggs to develop. The eggs hatch within hours to a day, depending on the temperature. And then the first instars, the first stage of the larvae, last a few more days, depending on the temperature. And they go into a second instar and then a third instar larval stages. Once they go into the third instar, they'll continue to feed on the resource. And then eventually, we're not sure the physiological mechanisms behind this, but then they start wandering off, or they migrate from the resource, trying to find a dark, dry place to go through pupation. And so then they become a pupae, often in the soil or under leaf litter, where they spend another known amount of time before emerging as adults and starting the cycle over.
So now then, the police, when they need your help with a case, well, first of all, do they ever come to you personally? I have to know that.
Yes, I've been involved with several cases that we'd rather not talk about at this point because they're still in the process. But I've also been involved with other cases that we've published on and I was a part of with other researchers.
So maybe paint me a picture, sir. How does that look practically?
So a medical examiner or someone from the investigative service or perhaps a detective, they'll be sitting with evidence and they've collected it and they will ask if you would be able to evaluate that insect evidence for perhaps the time of death or any kind of information that you can give them. So that's one way that we often become involved. And others, and which is probably a preferred way, and I haven't done a lot of this, but other scientists have, is they're called to actually attend the crime scene. And so they'll go to the crime scene, they will do the insect evidence collections, and then they will bring the evidence back to their laboratories and do the identifications, do the analysis, and then also write up a report.
And how accurate are you able to be, really? Because there, as you said earlier, there are so many variables, more than just time, right?
That is actually a huge question right now. What I can say is when I've worked with much more experienced forensic entomologists, they are fairly confident that once they've done a case and they've provided estimates of a time since death or time since colonization by the insects, and then they find out later in the case, oftentimes 5 to 10 years later, it's surprisingly, I don't want to say accurate, but if you give a range of 2 to 3 days, oftentimes they found that the person did die within that 2 to 3 day range period. Now, if you want to begin putting more precise estimates on some of this with any kind of scientific rigor, then I think we start getting into more muddy water.
This is Science for the People, and I'm talking about forensic entomology with Dr. Eric Benbow. Are there specific challenges involved with just using insects? I mean, what with them moving and all?
There are numerous specific challenges with using insects. One substantial one being if a body is concealed, someone commits a homicide, they hide the body, they wrap it and conceal it in plastic or something like that, and then put it into a refrigerator and then move it a week later. And the investigators don't know that initially. And if you have insect evidence from that exposed body, that newly exposed body, you will make an estimate, but that estimate is going to be the time since the insect colonized the body, and that will not match up with the time of death. There are other forensic mechanisms to help determine that, but that's the one thing I think in forensic entomology you always have to be aware of. What we're doing is really trying to identify when the insects first started using that resource or colonizing that resource, and that's not always crystal clear.
You yourself have been involved in some interesting research around one very specific challenge. How did you find yourself studying migrating maggots?
you get into the field as a scientist because you intrinsically just want to know and understand some of these processes. Decomposition of vertebrates or humans is not most appealing to a lot of people. But we wanted to start improving some of the science behind the decomposition process. And so my student and I wanted to investigate if you monitored several different resources at the same time, one, what kind of variation in the insect communities would you find? And two, what kind of microbial communities are associated with this decomposition. In that one particular study, my student went out to make collections, do some observations of the decomposition process, and serendipitously noticed that the entire carcass was consumed by maggots. Essentially, most of that carcass, I would say 90%, 95%, besides the bones, was converted from tissue of swine into tissue of blowfly maggots. He took some pictures and nice video, and then came back about 2 hours later, hour and a half later. That entire mass on two of these carcasses had moved about 25 meters away, which was completely fascinating to us because we had heard about post-feeding migrations and groups of maggots doing this, of individuals dispersing from a body or from a carcass, but not where 90% of the maggots themselves moved collectively 20 meters away, 25 meters away. To us, that was a really interesting surprise, but it also has some forensic ramifications. One, in most crime scene investigation protocols for collecting entomological evidence, you're advised to search a 10-meter radius around a carcass to look for pupae, to look for migrating maggots. And so what we documented is two out of six carcasses, the entire mass of insect evidence moved well outside of that search radius. And so the implications could possibly be, you know, investigators get to a crime scene, they don't find any or maybe a few maggots, they may not get the right size or the right species of the ones that were dominating the carcass. And so that could challenge the entomological evidence interpretation.
Well, and I understand that the older the maggot, the more accurate the time of death is going to be?
In general, that's the consensus. I think we're still investigating if that's exactly correct.
There is so much research that we never hear about. So there's, beyond yours, are there more interesting studies or maybe technology coming out of forensic entomology or more questions that need answering to increase accuracy, perhaps?
Yes. I think in many ways, forensic entomology is becoming much more of a multidisciplinary discipline. Well, we have the technology now to begin to understand some of the non-insect processes in communities like microbes that might actually be influencing the insects in a way that could have forensic ramifications. Some colleagues out of Texas A&M recently demonstrated that certain bacteria, if they're allowed to communicate with quorum sensing, they attract a certain blowfly. If you remove the capability of the bacteria to quorum sense or to communicate between themselves, the blowflies are not as attracted to that bacteria. And so I think that's one of the first pieces of evidence to suggest that there's something much more complicated going on between insects, the source, the body, and perhaps the microbes that are inherently part of the body. And the technologies, I think, will allow us to really uncover many of those mechanisms. And I think that's going to change how we view, you know, how quickly does a blowfly of a certain species of a certain geographic area, how quickly does it make it to a resource and why? I think we're at the verge of some really exciting and new biology related to forensic entomology.
You have a fascinating job, sir. And you also mentor students. So I was wondering, what would you say would be good characteristics for someone who is considering a career in the field? Like, what kind of person might be well suited?
One that can't smell real well. I think attention to detail, and I think it's becoming more quantitative, a very more quantitative mind, and a person that's not afraid or has less inhibition to put their hands and sample something that's dead. I think as humans, we are naturally repulsed from the decomposition process of another human being. And I think of also other vertebrates. I think the smell is part of that repulsion. And so I think it just takes someone that can be quite objective, keep focused on the question at hand, have really good attention to detail, and be persistent and standardized in the way that they either do the research or that the way that they collect evidence and interpret that evidence.
I have one last question, and I have to ask it or else I will get emails. How much is your field really like CSI?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Great answer.
Yeah. Yeah, not at all. I give a lecture tomorrow, and that's one of the first things I talk about. This is what it's portrayed like on TV, and now I'm going to give you what it really is like. And it's so less glamorous than what they make it out to be.
Eric, thanks so much for your time.
All right, thank you very much.
And we've linked to Eric Benbow on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, click the links to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and to subscribe to the show in iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.